Well, no surprise, we are in Luke 2 and Matthew 2, so if you've got a Bible, you might want to turn there, but more quickly if you haven't, we'll put it in here and I will read it to you in a sec. So we're just going to, just to remind you of the story, like many of you might have forgotten, you know, the Christmas story. But I'm going to read Luke 2 and then we'll read a couple of bits from Matthew. So this is Luke 2, 1 to 7. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken for the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to his own town to register. So Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloth and cloths and placed him in a manger, but there was no room left in the inn. And then we'll go to Matthew. This is Matthew 2. This is going to be a couple of sections. So Matthew 2, 1 to 3. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where was the one who was born king of the Jews? We saw him star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So I'm just going to flip over the page to verse 16. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, I was going to go ding, ding, ding. Well, that's pretty inappropriate. He was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys from Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Classic. I did a little Google Maps search this morning. How far is it from Nazareth to Bethlehem? It'll take you 2 hours and 8 minutes in the car. It'll take you just over 3.5 hours on public transport and 33 hours to walk. But I thought that was quite nice. Anyway, where was Jesus born? Oh, it's scary when you know the answer. Bethlehem. It's very clear. Scripture, both these fellows, Matthew and Luke, both will give us very different stories, actually. We've amalgamated them in the Nativity, and in doing so, we've lost their uniqueness sometimes. But they both tell us Bethlehem. So Jesus was born in Bethlehem. And all of the, even the most, you know, non-Christian archaeological scholars, all the liberal people, there's no doubt that's where Jesus was born. Even Matthew's little quote from Isaiah, you know, kind of bringing a prophetic word in there, that still doesn't bring any doubt to his geographical location. When was he born?
9.5.
Nice. There's answering questions one behind it. It's like a sketch on two volumes.
King Herod.
Lovely. So we're in minus 4 then, quote unquote. 4 BC, 5 BC, something like that. Time of King Herod. Now, when we do the story, when we look at the movies, when we do the nativity story, Mary is always traveling very heavily pregnant, isn't she? You always see that when you big, there's always a child with a large balloon stuck in a jumper, and they get to Bethlehem, and she's Jesus is instantly born, and shepherds instantly appear, and kings pretty quickly come after that. But when we look at what these fellows tell us, actually, they don't tell us that. They say that they travelled. They tell us he was pregnant, and they tell us they were travelled. And Luke says, while they were there. And that idea that Mary's travelling in her third trimester, heavily pregnant, is probably ludicrous. If you think about this, look at some of the women thinking, would you fancy that 80 mile journey by car or donkey or camel? Doesn't tell us any of those creatures. We don't get any of that. Would you fancy that? You probably wouldn't, would you? So the likelihood is of being in Bethlehem at least a little while. We don't know for sure, but at least a little while. Matthew just doesn't even tell us that they're set off from Nazareth. He just goes straight to Bethlehem, which was a bit of a shock to me yesterday when I was preparing to go, what? Oh, yeah, look at that. So Bethlehem, without doubt, Jesus' birth, and Mary's definitely pregnant. How pregnant, we don't know. But we do know that something like that, don't we? We do know that Luke says, while we were there, the time came for her to give birth. So she's born in Bethlehem, Jesus, born in Bethlehem, sometime 4-5 BC, sometime after they've arrived there. Where? So we're boiling it down now. Is Jesus born in an inn? Is he born in a stable? Is he born in a cave? Is he born somewhere else? Very, very interesting. If you're good enough like me, you might find it quite not interesting, but I found this fascinating. Luke gives us a word. I'm giving you a word on the little handout there. And it says Cataluma. Cataluma. And it is only translated in Luke. And Luke uses it again. When Jesus sends his disciples to go prepare a place for the Passover, they go and prepare a place in an upper room. It is a Cataluma. It is probably not an inn. It's definitely not a cave. It's probably not an inn. It probably is a house. Now we look at the house next to us there. We need to think a little bit about Bible translation at this point. You get the full lockdown here at Deep Possession. When you think about Bible translation, when you're translating one language into another, it needs to be accurate in the sense of what does this word mean, but it also needs to make sense. And those two things are often quite difficult to put together. They call it dynamic equivalence. So they're trying to make the words make sense in your world. So when the Bible is translated into English in, Wycliffe, 1380s, into Welsh, William Morgan in the 1580s, into German, Martin Luther in the 1550s, when you think about the culture that they're translating the Bible into. So the culture that those guys are in, the European culture, is a culture of inns and hotels. And the culture of Bethlehem isn't. Bethlehem's a small place at this time, and it's not a Roman garrison. It's highly unlikely that there was anywhere for people to go and stay. But when you're translating that into your language, it needs to make sense to the people who are reading it. So it's become in. The NIV translates it, Jesus is no room in the inn. But actually, the probably we're talking about a family home, and the family home is on your little sheet there. And that is a typical, archaeologically unearthed family home of in Israel in the first century. You've got basically a two-tier dwelling. You've got on the ground floor, you've got some kitchen area, and you've got the place where you keep your livestock, probably not loads of livestock. You're a family. You might have goats. You might have sheep if you're wealthy. You might have a cow, but probably not. So you've got a bit of livestock, and that is probably where Jesus was born. The Cataluma means upper room or guest room. And so maybe just come to this family home. Who does the home belong to? Well, we don't know, but we're in a possibly more hospitable culture than we live in now, and they get a room. Is it Joseph's ancestral family? Is it Mary's ancestral family? I'm not really sure. It's quite awkward having Santa Claus get ready for the view, isn't it? But I'm going to keep going. Yeah, that's great. I've spotted it, yeah. Interestingly, the Syrian and Egyptian scriptures. So, as the Bible moves with the early church, it's a long time before it gets translated into English, but it gets in Frankish quite early, and it's in Syrian, Syriac, and Egyptian within the first century. And they are from different cultures, from most living around it, and that the word is never translated in those places because they haven't got in the Bible. It's always translated upper room or guest room or something like that. Out of that is the idea that Bethlehem is small. There's a guy called W.F. Albright who was, he's died in the 80s, but he was a leading American archaeologist and sociologist, and he did a lot of work on the archaeology of the Middle East. His stuff on pottery records is still like the standard. So you find a piece of pottery, it's him who went, oh, this is from the first century, this is from the second century. So he's still a standard in archaeological teaching. And he kind of rebelled against the idea of the day that Luke, actually that the scripture was inaccurate. He was the first guy who really went, no, Luke is a really good historian, and we're going to trust him and see where he takes us. And he kind of pushed that. And, but he did a lot of work on the size of the populations of Jesus' time. And he reckoned that at the time of Jesus, when Jesus was born, Bethlehem had a population of about 300, which kind of makes us go, oh, look at that. And they then explained that and said, so you're talking 7 children, or 10, or if they had a really good year, you know, in the World Cup, 30. But it's a really small place. There's only 25,000 people in Bethlehem today. So, you know, so even though it's a city, the city of David, it was a small place. But that was interesting. So, any questions on that point before we go from stables? And that's an afternoon, I've got caves to do on everything caves yet. Sorry, I'm moving ahead too quick. To go. So, I'm serving this morning. It's horrible, isn't it? But there's no inn, and there's no inn in there. And last week I thought there was no donkeys. I mean, it's just grim, isn't it? So, we've got this place of home, people coming. But one idea that pops up often is a cave. I think was it Jesus of Nazareth, the film where Jesus is born in the cave? What are the Jesus films? Maybe not? No, it doesn't matter. But you do get that sometimes, you know, this idea that, and there is caves outside Bethlehem, and they were used for storage of animals, but they are outside Bethlehem. Luke is very specific. Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and Cataluma is never translated cave. So we can probably get rid of that one. By Matthew gets in on the action. He doesn't use Cataluma. He uses oikos, which means house or home. Actually, it's probably more effective, probably better to say home. So he Matthew's kind of comes in a little bit later. Jesus is born already. Doesn't give as much detail there. And then he's into the Magi. Because of what he says in Matthew 2:16, we assume the Magi come when Jesus is weaned and already a toddler, because Herod wants to kill all the children 2 years and under. So they've gone from a borrowed place. Jesus was born maybe upstairs, and there's no space to stay because the place the house is full. Is it full because of the census? Is it full just because it's a small building and it's full of people? He's laid in a manger, it's a stone trough. The animals aren't kept in there all the time, it's night time only, so that, you know, the animals don't get any feed or whatever, the baby's in there. And by the time Matthew gets on the scene, it's a different story, because they're not bothering somewhere. It seems to have gotten their own place. It's not a house, it's a home. So they've settled, at least for a little while, in Bethlehem. Any questions at that point? I have a
concern.
There's
something more than the area below, you know, where the animals were kept.
Yeah, definitely. Somewhere in that home. Yeah.
About Jesus' birth.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So shall we go on to Herod's grave? Give an understanding of this one. Let's think about Herod. He's kind of the great baddie, isn't he? He's an incredible character. As we learned last week, Dionysius got his summons wrong in 6 BC, so he projected where we were up to in world history and got it wrong a bit. So we are a little bit of a head of ourselves, a little bit behind, whatever. Jesus was not born in Zebo, he was born before that, almost definitely, because Herod is dead in 4 BC, and Jesus is born during the reign of Herod. Okay. So we need to think about who this man is. Is he the great Jewish king? Well, Herod, he calls himself king of the Jews, but he isn't. He isn't a Jew. He's an Idumean, an Edomite. So he's of the line of Esau. So if you think about that, he is, they sometimes call him a half Jew, which I think is a bit misleading. But he's a cousin, if you like, you know, ancestrally. He's a Jewish cousin. So Jacob and Esau, Jesus is if you like of the line of Jacob, and he's Herod, who's the line of Esau. But he's part of this. He lives in this incredible time of world history. So we've got General Pompey, Julius Caesar, Caesar Augustus, Mark Antony, Cleopatra, all these incredible people that we still have some influence, if you like, in our lives now, are alive during the time of Herod, and of course Jesus. In fact, Cleopatra is best friends, or close friends, with one of Herod's mothers-in-law. He's married 10 times, so you have 10 mothers-in-law. But one of his mothers-in-laws is his main wife, Marianne. She is really close friends with Cleopatra. And he gets into all sorts of trouble because his wife keeps saying to Cleopatra, stop him doing that, will you? And then she has a little word with Mark Antony, and Mark Antony calls him to speak to the Roman Senate. Isn't that awesome? How that really, I thought that was amazing. I like that kind of stuff. So here he is. He's living in this place. And it's I've got a few books on it if you want to really get into the history. But essentially, we've got this really convoluted rise to fame. His father's called Antipater II. And like Herod, he's not Jewish. He's an Edomite. But he is part of the ruling class. He's part of the political class of the day. And he is essentially the power behind the throne. John Hyrcanus II is the last of a line of 100 years of Jewish kings who were also high priests. I've never come across that before. We often talk about Jesus being king and priest only. And actually there is a model there already within Judaism, which is fascinating. So 100 years before this, are you with me? Complex, I know it's complex. So 100 years before this, the Syrian Emperor Antiochus Epiphanes has invaded Israel, invaded Jerusalem, has taken the temple, has put a pig's head in the temple. That's often called the abomination. It's called the abomination of the big desolation. That I see? Yeah. That appears a few times in scripture. So, and the Maccabees, these 4 or 5 brothers, they rise up, they raise an army, they attack the Syrians, and they've been freedom to Israel for about 100 years. So 100 years later, their ancestor is on the throne. He's also high priest, John Hyrcanus, but he is a weakling. And Rome is pressuring. Rome is coming. And there's a civil war between these two brothers, fueled by Rome and Herod's father. So he's behind the throne of this weakling, basically stirring the pot. And by AD 37, the Jewish throne has collapsed. Rome is annexed Palestine, has annexed Israel, and has put their man on the throne, who's called Herod, and we often call him Herod the Great. There you go. That's about 100 years of history in 5 seconds. So he becomes this. He becomes this very powerful person, Herod the Great. He didn't get that title obviously until much later. So here we are, Herod the Great and Cruel. Did Herod kill those babies? The only record of those children being killed is scriptural. We have got no other history. Not Josephus or Tacitus or any of those people, no one can tell us about the murder of infants. And that has led some historians to go, it's not true then, is it? You know, it's one of those Bible things. It's good to address those things and then get hold of it. We need to look at Herod's wider picture and go, has he got form? Would he do this? And also recognise that Bethlehem is quite small. So we're not talking hundreds or thousands of children. We're talking not too many at all. Now I'm not sure he is any more cruel than the other leaders of the nations around him. But he definitely is cruel. So his, I've already mentioned his main wife, Marianne. Every time he got into trouble with Rome, which happened quite often because she kept writing to her friend Cleopatra, he'd get called to whoever the local Roman leader was, once or twice to Rome itself. Every time he left the country, he left orders for her to be killed if he didn't come back. So if I don't come back, you finish her off. He killed at least 3 of his children. One of his sons was when he died, his kingdom was divided into 4. The 4 people he named as successors, 3 sons and a half brother or something. One of his sons just weeks before he died, he hasn't killed him because he decides he's not worthy of a bit of, you know, a bit of his of his real estate. He leaves a message in his will that when he dies, his son should gather the leading men of Jericho and take them to the amphitheatre and kill them, so that people will cry at Herod's funeral. So he's that kind of character, you know. He's just got this, you know, this evil going through him. And because of the influence of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and because he's not a Jew, he can't be high priest. So the guy before him was king and priest, but he can't be high priest, he's not a Jew. So the high priesthood is given to his nephew, and the nephew does really well. And the Josephus talks about the Passover under his nephew and how well it had gone. You think, oh, that's amazing, isn't it? But the pastor, isn't it, organising Christmas. Oh, so, how did Christmas go this year at our church? It was bonkers, oh, it was amazing. The report that he did really well, and then he mysteriously drowns at home in a teaspoon of water, you know. It was like, what? And, you know, everyone said, Herod had been killed. But there was no proof that he did. But he did really well, and then before you know it, he's dead. That is the character we're dealing with. And so when we come to these biblical stories that none of you, I'm sure, have any doubts about, but friends that you know have doubts about, what do you do with that? You say, well, let's have a look at this guy. Let's see the things he did. Let's look at the life he had. Let's look at his political shenanigans and see how he operated. Is this likely? Oh, yes, it is. And that really helps us, doesn't it, in a bit of apologetics. One of the questions I've often had is why Herod didn't go to see Jesus. I might even have mentioned this in sermons. You know, if the wise man come and says, there's one kingdom of the Jews, because that's just what he thinks, well, I'm above that, it's just a behavior, go and sort it out. But why did he do more? And it would appear that he was incredibly ill. He lived quite a long time. He lived till he was 73 BC, before 69? All right? Yeah. Almost master's terminal. So for his day and age, he was old. But the kind of the historians of the book, Mr. Plummer, have read all the reports of his death, and it appears he was seriously unwell. He had chronic kidney failure, I think, because of probably alcoholism. And as part of that, he had a particular type of gangrene, which is a bit like that flesh-eating, fasciitis, necrotizing fasciitis. He had a form of that. It was a pity he died horribly, painfully. And he wasn't really up to go on visiting babies. It's not relevant to us, but gets us going, doesn't it? You know, he was paranoid his whole life. He was trying to keep all the power his whole life. And acts of violence against anybody who even pushed against that power were not uncommon. Did he kill those children? He definitely did. That's all right, that can go. So was he great? He's called Herod the Great. He's called Herod the Great because he had other Herods come after him. But was he great? He actually was an incredible character. And he did he was a good leader. The Pharisees hated him because he wasn't Jewish. But a lot of the people of the land loved him. At one point he slashes taxes by two-thirds for the people of Israel. And it's basically a ploy. He wants the people to love him. And he tells the Romans that they've had, you know, just terrible famine, and you know, the harvest's been shocking for year after year after year. And so he cuts what he's given to Rome, but he also passes it on to the people. A lot of the people loved him. Just the really religious who hated him. He started the building of the temple. So Herod's temple was an amazing thing. One rabbi said, whoever has not seen the temple of Herod has not seen a beautiful building. It's amazing to have seen that. It wasn't finished a lot after his death. It wasn't finished very long before the Romans set it off the town again. But absolutely brilliant beauty. And the stuff that he built is still the most, you know, go wander around Israel today and see it. That picture on the handout at the bottom right is his, is it called an amphitheatre? It's not totally round. It's like a half moon theatre thing. But that's my thought. So I went and sat on those steps and looked at the stage in Caesarea. Caesarea was called Strato's Tower till Herod got hold of it, revamped it, built a hippodrome for horse racing, built this amphitheatre right by the sea, and then named it in honour of Caesar. Incredible builder, incredible man, you know, in for his day, but also incredibly grim. And I guess for us, the challenge is, you know, given the opportunity to encounter Jesus, he doesn't bother, he stays at home, he obviously Jesus was only a baby at the time, but he could have, how life could have been different for him. But there you go, born in the barn, really, possibly, and Herod the Great, for all. I thank you. Any questions, any comments? Any disagreement? I'm going to have that as well.
There's another tradition that he may have been born around Feast of Tabernacles. And some people think that maybe it was a tabernacle or a soup that they set up at that time. You know, that they would, for that week, they would live in that. And that's another possibility.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So this is Tom Mary Joseph, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
It's just I
thought that was a thought, didn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's highly unlikely. Terrible, isn't it? It's highly unlikely that Jesus was born in December. Because you know, Bethlehem it will be cold. Would the shepherds be on the field in the fields in December? Now, some say they were looking after the special sheep that were for the sacrifice, but even that, they probably would have been inside. It's more likely he was born in April. But there you well, you know, Luke and Christopher don't bother about that, they don't tell us. So that's good, I like that,
yeah.
Any others?
Gives us a bit more time to plan for Christmas then, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Well, he's going to be busy, won't he? Yeah. But if you, you know, if we kick in with Passover like you should do anyway, would everyone be happy, wouldn't they? Get it all over in one moment. Any more? Thanks for coming.
Okay.
Go and have a cup of coffee in the meantime.
Thank you.